From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Congress has adjourned for the summer. On today's Fresh Air, we go behind the scenes with New York Times reporter Carl Hulse. He'll share his insights on the growing partisan rancor on Capitol Hill and on the issues of the day, including the Gonzalez hearings, eavesdropping laws, ethics reform, and Iraq. Also, film critic David Edelstein tells us the story about the new film Interview, directed by and starring Steve Buscemi. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in this week for Terry Gross. Congress has adjourned for the summer, but not before enacting some substantive legislation and engaging in plenty of acrimonious debate. The Senate held an all-night session on Iraq, and Republicans actually walked out of the House chamber Thursday night. There were major battles with the Bush administration over Alberto Gonzalez and energy policy, but Congress did manage to raise the minimum wage, adopt new electronic surveillance guidelines, and get an ethics and lobbying law passed. For some perspective, we turn to Carl Hulst, the chief congressional correspondent for the New York Times. He's been covering Congress for more than 20 years. He spoke to us this morning. Well, Carl Hulst, welcome to Fresh Air. Congress finally adjourned for August. And as we know, in Congress, there's always two versions of what happened, the Republican version and the Democratic version, and then the rest of us try and figure it out as we can. What do the Democrats say about what they got done?
Well, the Democrats, of course, say that they had the most productive 7 months in the history of Congress, so that's their judgment. And they did accomplish a few things. Of course, the Republicans have the complete opposite view.
What's their view?
That this was the do-nothing Congress, or they're trying to tag it as the post office Congress because they've done a lot of post offices, namings, that sort of thing. And that's a talking point for them now. Obviously, the truth is somewhere in the middle somewhere.
Right. Well, let's go through some of the areas where significant legislation was debated and in some cases enacted. One most recently was electronic eavesdropping, and that activity on that went right into the weekend. I guess at the end of the session, the House amended the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which we know of because of this controversy, which the Times generated a couple of years ago when they exposed warrantless wiretapping. Now, President Bush wanted changes in this act. What changes did he want and why?
Well, the administration was arguing that some recent, actually still classified decisions had been preventing them from eavesdropping on foreign terrorist suspects, communicating with other foreign terrorist suspects overseas, but with the communication passing through communication nodes, I guess you would say, in the U.S. And they said that they needed some revisions to accommodate that. Of course, that bill got passed. This is not one the Democrats are going to claim as part of their 6 for 06 or one of their accomplishments. They detested the bill in some respects, especially in the House. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, said the revisions did violence to the Constitution. They allowed it to go through late Saturday night because they were really sort of in a political bind. One member told me, called it a vice, because they didn't want to do it, but they didn't want to leave for August and have something happen and get the blame. So that was approved, but over very strong objections from the Democrats. So the Republicans would claim that as a win, really. And it was an interesting situation. Only 41 Democrats voted for that bill. It was obviously mainly Republicans who passed it. And the Democrats now say that they'll come back before the 6 month expiration. This is an interim bill, and try and fix it. They're very angry about the way this was sort of rammed down their throats, they would say.
Now, this is such a difficult area, both because the technology is complicated and evolving, and also because so much of it is classified. Now, there in the past for years has been the secret court, the FISA court, which the government could go and get a warrant for eavesdropping in. As we've said, a lot of controversy was generated because it turned out that the government was bypassing the court. Now that this act has been passed, and understanding that it's a 6 month law, is it clear what the government can do in this area of surveillance on American citizens?
Well, certainly not to me, but I think that's the rub here in some ways, that the Democrats say that this now can really allow wiretapping of Americans as long as they're without a warrant, as long as they're potentially talking with one of these foreign targets, and that's the Democrats' complaint. They would say that the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, came to them with a series of fixes, and they agreed to those. And then when they agreed to those, the administration wanted more and took this farther. So, you know, there's a dispute about the scope of this. Also, a big problem for the Democrats, and actually, in honesty, some Republicans, was that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez gets new power in the way this is set up. And, of course, Mr. Gonzalez is not a favorite on Capitol Hill, and they did not want to give him this.
What new power does he get?
My understanding of this is that he and the director of national intelligence sort of jointly decide where this wiretapping can occur, or at least sign off on it. You know, I'm sure they don't make the basic decision, and this is happening without judicial review.
Yeah, you know, it's just so puzzling because the laws obviously have to be written on paper in English, in black and white, and yet it's still not exactly clear.
Well, it's a classified program, and you can't really tell what they're doing, and they're talking, you know, about the internet and voice over internet protocol and, you know, things that are way beyond me, obviously.
All right, but the upshot is that the administration gets more power to conduct surveillance without warrants than it had before Congress acted, right?
Right, under the objection, because of the objections that had been raised to the program. Now, I don't know, you know, if at the origination of this program, whether or not they were doing this and then were stopped, but they definitely had been stopped somewhere in the interim and now do have new power, correct?
Well, one of the big things that Congress wanted to get done and at least enacted legislation about is ethics reform. There'd been a whole series of scandals over the past few years. Let's go through some of the areas of concern that Congress tried to address in this ethics and lobbying bill and see how well it met the task. First of all, disclosure about what lobbyists do, the kind of money they raise. How far did the law go in addressing abuses of lobbyists?
Well, they've got the main thing that they aimed at, which was bundling. Now, it was watered down somewhat from what they had originally proposed. This is a kind of a inside Washington trick where lobbyists collect money from a series of people. You know, obviously there's limits on individual contributions, but one lobbyist will go and collect from partners or people at fundraisers and then deliver a bundle, literally is what they call it, a bundle of checks. So then you call this bundling. There's been no previous disclosure of this practice. The complaint about it was that it gives one person really the ability to deliver money above the individual contribution limit, and, you know, you can get special influence that way. So they have set it up so there's disclosure once a lobbyist exceeds $15,000 in a six-month period. The congressman or the person running for office at that point, senator too, will have to file a report with the Federal Election Commission disclosing who that person is. So, you know, they got it. The lobbying bill overall, a lot of complaints, you know, that it was watered down, didn't go far enough, and then on the other side that it does too much. But this was a pretty significant piece of legislation. If you go through it provision by provision, there's some serious new things in there, and revolving door provisions it's probably going to cause some people to leave the Hill this year before it takes effect, really.
Let's get to that in a second, but just to be clear about the bundling thing, it is still legal for a lobbyist to go out and collect 40 checks from their friends and deliver it to a candidate, but now it must be disclosed so you know who's wielding that influence.
Yes, that's true, and we'll see how that all works and how they set up the disclosure. There was a difference of opinion. Originally, the lobbyist was going to have to disclose it as part of the lobbying disclosure process. Now it'll be up to the member of Congress through the FEC, and there'll be some wrinkles there, obviously. But it will be a new disclosure. Actually, this bill has a lot of new disclosure and databases, public databases. So in some ways, it wasn't that it stopped practices, but what the bill's trying to do is make both the lobbyists and the lawmaker disclose further and make those disclosure reports more easily publicly available. Right now, you have to go in some cases, to an office in the Capitol. And I mean, the normal person isn't going to do that.
So citizen watchdog groups and bloggers can mine this stuff? And
yeah, I think there's a real big new potential for that. One of the groups that worked on this, I think the name of it is Sunlight Foundation, and that's their big push is to for disclosure, you know, and then people can do with it what they will. And I do think that, you know, this will take years really to move into effect. But I do think there's going to be a lot more Googling through these databases, really.
Now, tell us what the law did in terms of addressing these issues about interaction between lobbyists and lawmakers and their staffs, the people, you know, leaving Capitol Hill and going right into lobbying firms, in some cases congresspeople pressuring lobbying firms on who to hire. What did it do about those issues?
Well, the pressuring the lobbying firms, it banned that. That goes back to the famous or infamous, however you want to consider it, the K Street Project, where Republicans, when they took control of the House in 94, began to pressure associations and big firms downtown to hire Republicans. So that practice is actually banned. If members of Congress or senior staff want to negotiate to leave Congress, they're going to have to disclose who they're talking to. And the Senate, they added, they made the revolving door 2 years, so you can't have lobbying contacts with people on the Hill for 2 years. And I think that's going to be, there's a lot of unhappiness in the Senate over that, really, because the House was able to stay at 1 year. There was a lot of objections to the House, in the House, to making that tougher. So
help us understand that one provision. We're talking about people like staff members who leave Capitol Hill, then go to a lobbying firm. And then, first of all, what exactly is wrong with that, and how is it addressed here?
Well, I think that the traditional objection to it is that you're immediately leaving Congress, leaving your office. You're the committee person, say, you're the chief committee counsel, and that you're immediately going out, and then you can turn around and use your contacts, people that you just worked with very closely, issues that you may have handled, and that you would then have an unfair advantage and can kind of work things through.
Doesn't that arrangement also suggest that a private interest might dangle in front of a staff member, hey, help us out with this particular issue, and you will get a nice fat
job? That's what happens. That happened in the Jack Abramoff scandal. He was basically, according to the charges against him, he was basically sort of had people working in-house on these committees with promises of full employment when they got out and big money. So in a way, they were kind of doing their future job while they were doing their present job. So they want to ban that. Interestingly, they've tightened up the contacts. There were some loopholes in before that you couldn't talk maybe to your office or your committee. Now you're banned from full contact, lobbying contact with people on the Hill, lawmakers and staff. And they've increased the penalties, I think to $250,000 for a violation of that. So it's pretty serious now, and I'm not sure people are going to risk it.
So it sounds like you think that there's some significant changes here in the interaction between.
Yeah, we'll see. The people in Washington always find a way around everything. I think what they did was go and look at some of the practices that have been a problem in the past few years and try and rein them in. Now, whether or not they can actually do it, or if there's going to be enforcement of it, or all sorts of things, I can't predict that. I do think that the bill has some potentially tough provisions in it, and we'll have to see how they're enforced and carried out and how smart people are getting around them.
We're speaking with Chief Congressional Correspondent of the New York Times, Carl Hulse. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the New York Times Chief Congressional Correspondent, Carl Hulse. One of the areas of ethics reform that was a high priority was dealing with earmarks, this strange practice by which Congress members can add millions and millions of dollars in spending without ever having to even disclose that they were, the motivating party behind it. Poor candidate in silence, if you will. How well did the act address that issue?
I think that's kind of a mixed bag. There's going to be new disclosure of earmarks, and there already is, and we've seen it coming out, reports in the House so far listing all the earmarks. The objection in the Senate from the conservatives was that the parliamentarian, who is supposedly nonpartisan officer of the Senate, was going to be the one to judge whether the earmarks had been properly disclosed in these bills or not. That power was given to the majority leader and I think the chairman of the appropriate committee, you know, their critics were saying that is obviously going to lead to trouble. But on the other hand, there is significant new disclosure of these projects and who's behind them. You know, there's always going to be some that don't get disclosed. So in some ways, it's like the databases that I was talking about earlier that, you know, the practice is going to continue. People are going to continue to do this, but at least there's a way now to see who it is. You know, I've covered Capitol Hill for 20-some years, and before you really would struggle to even identify what the earmarks were in these bills. They were written in such a way that you could not really tell what they were or who they were. It would sometimes take weeks to figure it out. Now we'll get a list of these. Actually, and the Times had a story over the weekend that, oddly enough, this has already driven up earmarking because people are trying to get, you know, they see what other people are getting, say, hey, I need to get some of that. So it always has the unintended consequences, and, you know, it could turn out to cause more earmarking. Members have said, you know, one of the reasons they don't like to disclose earmarks is because then the people that they didn't get them for come and complain to them. So we'll have to see how it works. But there is new disclosure.
One of the other areas that the reform dealt with was additions and holds on legislation, which senators and congresspeople were unable to effectuate without anybody knowing it. And again, this is one of those things that I think just as a citizen is really shocking, that people can add things to laws kind of in the middle of the night with and nobody knows who added it. And they can also, I guess in the Senate at least, put an anonymous hold on a legislation which would delay or even kill something. And again, leave no fingerprints. Has this issue been dealt with?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I, you know, these are two things that are sort of buried in the bill, but that I personally think could potentially be some of the biggest things. The dead of night provisions, which is what they're called up here, were in the final conference report. I know Congress is complicated, but at the end of the process, and the House and the Senate get together and work out the final bill, a lot of times, like right before it comes back to a final vote, they would stick in a provision that nobody knew about, and the only way you could get it out was to destroy the whole bill. Now, in the Senate, you'll be able to challenge those specific provisions. That is actually, and it sounds obscure and wonky, but it actually has the potential to be a big deal. So that's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. I don't think people have quite gotten the potential ramifications of that. Holds, of course, are just a great Senate institution in a way because they're so bizarre, but you know, if there's a bill that comes along or a nomination particularly and a member doesn't like it, he can just call over the cloakroom and say he's got a hold on the bill. And that doesn't necessarily lead to the identity of that person becoming known. I actually wrote a story about this last week and got into some of the funny names for the holds when you call over. And if you put a hold on a bill because you want to negotiate, that's called the Mae West hold because, you know, to come up and see me sometime and we'll talk about that. Then there's the chokehold, which was meant to kill the bill entirely. And then the rotating hold, which is a favorite of mine, where critics and opponents switch from person to person, so you can't really identify who's doing it. So now under this bill, there's still loopholes, but at least within 6 days of putting the hold on, 6 days of the session, you have to file a little piece of paper that'll then be printed in the congressional record saying why you've got the hold on the bill and who you are. And, you know, that's new. These have been going on for about a half a century, and a lot of times you never know who's putting the hold on. Senator Tom Coburn's got quite a few holds over in the Senate right now, but he told me that he wasn't going to be deterred by this. He doesn't care if people know he's got the hold on it. But if, you know, if there's a situation where you've got in the congressional record, you know, dozens of holds, I think it will probably make people less inclined to do it.
So we actually, some of our legislators actually face the prospect of their official actions on legislation being public.
Yeah, I know that's hard to get a handle on.
Overall, how would you grade this effort at reform?
I would say that I think it's going to be tougher and more effective than people initially are giving it credit for. There's a lot of things in this bill. You know, conventions, which are notorious places for lobbyists whining and dining, members of Congress, and I have to concede journalists, and that's going to be tougher under this bill. You know, there's little things. Now there's provisions that people have been trying to get through for years on various things, couldn't get them through alone. You know, there's electronic filing of campaign finance reports in the Senate, which a bill that had been subject to an anonymous hold. So,
right.
You know, they've got some things done. My concern would be that there's always a way around these things, and people will work hard to find them and, you know, get paid a lot of money to figure out a way to do it. So, but I think it's probably better than most people think.
Carl Hulse is chief congressional correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with New York Times correspondent Carl Hulse. We're talking about contentious issues facing the U.S. Congress. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Interview, directed by and starring Steve Buscemi. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Congress has adjourned for the summer, having enacted a new ethics and lobbying law and new electronic surveillance guidelines. Today we're talking about the substance, politics, and partisan atmospherics of congressional action with Carl Hulse, chief congressional correspondent for the New York Times. Well, let's talk about Iraq. I mean, probably the most dramatic event in recent months was the all-night debate in the Senate, COTS brought in for senators, not so widely used, I gather. And this sort of seemed to be a reflection of where Congress is, which is Democrats have a majority for opposing the war, but not a strong enough majority to do anything about it, right?
Yeah, that's true. And basically the, you know, throughout the year, the Democrats sort of started out at a point where they didn't think they would be able to do anything at all. But as the they saw that the public was siding with them, they kept pushing away on Iraq. But they just never had the votes to do it. Of course, in the supplemental, they did eventually get a timeline for withdrawal in the first version of the bill, which the president then vetoed and the Democrats backed away and sent the money to the president. They just still have not been able to assemble a strong majority in the Senate, or 60 votes is what you need for almost anything, to enact a timeline. In the House, they put off tough votes on Iraq. They could have done it, really. They could have had a series of votes Friday and Saturday, even when they were trying to rush through at the end. The defense spending bill was up, but they chose purposefully not to do that.
Why did they do that?
Because at this point, it just seemed like they were going to they had decided to wait until September. Obviously, there's this report coming back from General Petraeus and the ambassador there. They think that that could be a turning point. There's also a big political calculation here. They didn't want to take votes on provisions and proposals that would give Republicans the ability to go home over this next month and say, well, we didn't want a timeline, but I have voted to force the president to come up with a plan for withdrawal in the event we have to do it. So there was a real distinct political calculation, like, well, let's not give them anything. Let's go home. Let them go home. Hear from their voters. There's a big anti-war activist program going on the next few weeks in all the districts of these swing Republicans, and they're really going to try and put the heat on them. And then hopefully when they come back in September, others will be ready to join them.
Yeah, you know, you hear Republicans accusing the Democrats of manipulating the process so as to suppress votes on measures that they say would be meaningful steps towards a new direction in Iraq. The Democrats, of course, view these measures as nothing more than kind of political cover for the Republicans. Are the things the Republicans want votes on really new directions for Iraq?
Well, I think that they would, you know, they're sort of halfway measures if you would compare them up against the Democrat. There's no formal plan for withdrawal. Probably the most popular one in the Senate is just a plan that would incorporate the recommendations of the Iraq study group, which, you know, would suggest to the administration you take a series of steps that lead to conditions for a withdrawal next year, obviously. And that has bipartisan support, would have gotten a lot of votes. But the Democrats say it's a step backwards because you're not really requiring the president to do anything. The other plan in the House that would have gotten a lot of votes was one that just says the administration has to, within 60 days, come up with a plan for withdrawal. And that there was a chance they almost put that on the floor at the end, but they didn't quite do it. And you know, Democrats just think that falls short. But there is something to the Republican charge that Democrats didn't allow votes that would have gotten a lot of bipartisan support. And there were some Democrats who were unhappy with that as well. But that's the way it played out.
And it seems like the Democrats want to hang this albatross of support for Bush's war around the Republicans' neck for the summer, right?
Yeah, correct. Especially, you know, in the, say, Minnesota, you know, where Norm Coleman is up for reelection in a state that where there's a strong anti-war sentiment, you know, and there's a big program up there to keep the heat on him. So around the country, you'll see this group called Americans Against Escalation in Iraq, I think the name of it is. You know, they've got all sorts of events planned, and they'll be pushing them.
Well, let's talk about Alberto Gonzalez, the man of the hour on Capitol Hill. You know, for 6 months, Congress has been investigating the firing of U.S. attorneys. Gonzalez has been worked over thoroughly in Congress. I guess he sent some letters last week clarifying earlier testimony that was regarded as misleading. We have Karl Rove ignoring a congressional subpoena to appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and some members are talking about contempt of Congress proceedings and special prosecutors. Give us a sense of where this stands now. Are we going to continue to see this battle escalate?
Well, I think it'll continue. In some ways, I think the Democrats and even some Republicans are frustrated because it seems to them, no matter what they do or say or complain or show, that Mr. Gonzalez is going nowhere and he's got the president's support. and they just cannot dislodge him. As I said earlier, his name figured very prominently in the House debate Saturday on the FISA change, on the eavesdropping change, because they're so unhappy with him. I do think that this will continue to play out. You know, their last resort is impeachment. You've heard some people start to talk about it, but I just don't think Democrats want to go there. I do think that the fight over executive privilege will continue to play out. But it's, you know, once it gets in the courts, it's one of those things, and you know, this is what Senator Spector says all the time, that, you know, it'll just outlive the administration. You can't really get anywhere that way. Senator Spector, the Republican from Pennsylvania, senior Republican on judiciary, still keeps trying to work a deal where they could get some of this testimony in a compromise with the administration. But the administration, of course, you remember, is insisting on interviews of the key players without a transcript. And no one in Congress is going to go for that.
How much is this battle over, you know, an important issue, the potential political interference in criminal prosecutions, how much is this battle affecting the other work of Congress, just in terms of distraction, time spent, politics?
I think it is. I think it's a distraction, no doubt about it. I think that it was actually, I mean, it spilled over in a major way into this FISA dispute. And that shows you sort of the practical implications of these kind of fights. I do think it is
That's the electronic eavesdropping.
Correct. You know, because of this dispute made it much more difficult to get that accomplished. And, you know, that Congress can always find time to do what they really want to do. But there's no doubt that this is taking up some of the oxygen.
We're speaking with New York Times chief congressional correspondent Carl Hulse. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the New York Times chief congressional correspondent, Carl Hulse, about what Congress got done and didn't get done before it left for its August recess. Well, one thing that did happen was an energy bill. This is a big issue with global warming and gas prices being so high. The president doesn't much like this bill, and a lot of Democrats are disappointed with some aspects of it. What did Congress get done here?
Well, interesting thing about this bill to me is that it's Nancy Pelosi. It's a huge priority with her. Her name is on the bill in the House, and she's making this a major issue. The House on Saturday passed this energy bill, which really concentrates on energy efficiency in some respects and, you know, a lot of new standards along those lines. But the big vote in the House was to add this provision that will require utility companies to use, I think it's up to 15% of renewable fuels over X number of years, which would cut back on their usage of coal and natural gas and that sort of thing. So that got in a surprisingly easy vote, and then the bill passed with fairly good margin. So that they will now go into conference with the Senate, which passed an energy bill that had the auto mileage standards in it that have been tough to get through Congress for the past 20 years or so because of the power of the auto companies. So now when you go into conference, you have the possibility of the final bill, including both the new auto mileage standards and the renewable fuel standard for utilities. That's a big deal. I mean, that hasn't happened before. And if that comes out that way and is passed, sent to the president, you know, he's threatened to veto and probably would veto it, I would think.
Now, you wrote in a piece a few weeks ago that there's really been a sea change in Congress on this issue of fuel efficiency standards for American cars, that the power of the auto industry simply isn't what it used to be. Why not?
Well, I think that people have just for so long listened to the auto companies say, we can't do this. But now that they see, you know, these advances with hybrids and, you know, battery-powered cars, one of the before that vote in the Senate, you know, they had a couple of these experimental but usable cars that were parked across the street that get like 150 miles a gallon. And I think people just are frustrated and feel, come on, you have to be kidding me. All that's going on in America at this point with technology and the and you can't build cars to get, you know, another 10 miles per gallon. It just seems to them, that the auto companies need to step up to the plate at this point. And I think they've lost patience.
And you said the president may veto this measure. What does he not like about it?
Well, I think that the, you know, obviously the sort of conventional energy industry doesn't like it, coal and oil, natural gas. There's also the House put, would raise money for this program with taxes on oil companies. So that right there is probably a non-starter with the administration. The Senate didn't do that part, but the, you know, it's sort of a new approach on energy, and I just don't think it'll fly at the White House. And to be honest, there are Democrats in both the House and the Senate who don't like it. You know, it's the old question of big oil and coal versus, you know, some of these newer solar, wind sources, and it's just a clash at that level.
You know, I feel like we should give at least passing attention to the issue of health care. I mean, there seems to be a growing feeling in this country that the healthcare system just doesn't work. We got Michael Moore's movie being one powerful expression of that notion. And you got a couple of states that have tried to experiment with expanding health insurance for their citizens. Isn't pressure building on Congress to do something, and what's going to happen?
Yeah, I think that healthcare, you know, perhaps absent Iraq, could be the biggest issue of 2008. Now, the big healthcare bill in Congress right now is the Children's Health Insurance Plan, CHIP, S-CHIP, it's called. And that is going to be a big subject after the August break. Both the House and Senate, this is part of the Democratic push at the end, both the House and the Senate passed expansions of that program to get more kids onto these insurance plans. You know, it'd be kids who families aren't quite poor enough for Medicaid, but, you know, are having trouble getting their own health insurance, working parents, that sort of thing. Huge, huge fight, very tense in the House, and the Democrats managed to push it through, which is actually part of the reason that led to the Republicans fighting them so hard on other things, because they really didn't like this bill, and they got it through. Would finance, the House version of this would finance this through some reductions in Medicare, I think for Medicare HMOs. Now, the Senate had a much more bipartisan bill clear there, and they financed their expansion with tobacco tax increase. And so now these two bills are going to have to get worked out. The president has also threatened to veto this bill, but the Democrats think that if they can get a final bipartisan bill, you know, that has maybe a veto-proof majority in the Senate, I don't know about the House, through that it's going to be tough for him and Republicans to say that they were opposed to expansion of children's health care. This was a really interesting vote in the House, though, because both sides thought they got a victory. The Democrats thought that they were able to get through a bill that expanded children's health care and was going to be seen that way. Republicans really thought that the Democrats made a huge mistake by passing this bill that has Medicare cuts in it, and they think they're going to be able to use it against them. And they were actually, you know, as the vote was taking place on the House floor, waving goodbye at the Democrats, saying, well, you've made your fatal mistake here. So it's really an interesting thing where both sides thought that they had won. So this will be a major issue for the rest of the year, and is a big priority of the Democrats.
Well, you know, expanding children's health insurance, as important as it is just a piece of the national health care picture. And, you know, given the acrimony that accompanied the debate over children's health care and everything else, is there any chance that Congress will undertake a wider effort at reform next year?
I don't think so. I think this is it. The reason that the Republican, you know, there'll be other incremental health care bills, but the reason the Republicans and President Bush are opposed to this bill so strongly is because they see it as a step towards national health care. So in some ways, this is the political playing field for that fight right now. And I think if they can get this through, that this would be their accomplishment. I mean, the closer, once you get into 2008, you think it was hard to get things done this year, wait until 2008, right?
Right.
Once you get into that, almost getting anything done is going to be impossible.
Well, you know, when the Democrats took control of Congress, one of the things they talked about was changing the atmosphere, you know, all of this bitter partisanship that tends to govern debate there. From the cheap seats, it doesn't look like it's gotten any better, has it?
No, I think you can safely say that that hasn't quite worked out the way that they anticipated. It was a very ugly final few days in the House particularly, and it had been pretty ugly in the Senate and a couple of weeks before. The tensions on Capitol Hill are really bad right now. You know, I can't say it's the worst ever or the worst I've ever seen. But it's bad, and there's some reasons for it. One, the Democrats say in the House and at the end, they did accomplish a few things. They were really jamming through, grinding it out, so to speak, this legislative agenda, and they were running over the Republicans, and the Republicans got mad over it. So there were some really, really nasty fights on the floor, you know, stemming from that. There was a dispute late last Thursday over whether the Democrats tried to gavel down a vote that the Republicans had actually won, and it spilled over into all these privileged resolutions on the floor and calls for investigation. And, you know, it's going to go on for a while. There's a lot at stake here. The Republicans do not like being in the minority one bit, and they're very frustrated. Now, the question is, you know, does this really get out to the public, and is it an issue with them? It's sort of processy, you know, and if the Democrats are still getting some legislation through, are people going to pay attention to complaints from Republicans who did sort of the same things and even worse in some cases during the time they were in charge? So, but it is really, really tense, no doubt about it.
It was expected when the Democrats won control of Congress that congressional scrutiny of the administration would increase. Has this gone about as you expected, and has it been an important development in public life in Washington?
Well, I think it's been probably about what we thought, and that's what created this Gonzales situation in some respects, is because they were able to take the complaints and the firings of these U.S. attorneys and get a real investigation going into it. With the Republicans running Congress, I doubt if that would have gone anywhere. And we probably wouldn't be talking about what we're talking about with the Attorney General. I do think that they haven't quite gotten caught up with the oversight of just the executive branch in general. You know, where else there are big problems? It's a huge sprawling bureaucracy, and I haven't seen, you know, sort of the stories turned up out of some of these other agencies that I had hoped or expected would happen, you know, that have been going on that we don't know about. I don't think that means that the executive branch has been operating perfectly. I think it's just going to a matter of time for Democrats to get into those areas.
Is there one area in particular that you'd like to see?
It's just that you don't really know. I mean, the oversight of the oversight of the executive branch had been, I wouldn't say ignored. I mean, the Republicans didn't totally ignore it, but they certainly weren't aggressive about it over the past, during the time of the Bush administration. And you have to think that with all that's gone on here, that there's some problems that we just don't know about.
Well, Carl Hulse, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Carl Hulse is chief congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Coming up, David Edelstein on Interview, the new film directed by and starring Steve Buscemi. This is Fresh Air. The new film Interview is directed by Steve Buscemi, who also answers to Buscemi. It's a two-character drama starring Buscemi and Sienna Miller. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Interview is an American remake of a film by Theo van Gogh, the outspoken Dutch director who was murdered in 2004 by an Islamic extremist. It's not politically incendiary, but it's dramatically charged. It's a psychological duel to the death. Steve Buscemi plays Pierre Peters, a war correspondent stuck doing puff pieces on celebrities. Sienna Miller is Katya, the gorgeous primetime TV soap goddess and horror film actress he's assigned to talk to. She shows up very late to the trendy restaurant, feigning ordinariness but radiating entitlement. He wears his contempt like a boutonniere.
Katya.
The one and only.
What kind of a name is it?
It's a Russian name, Katya.
Are your parents Russian?
No, my mother is Dutch, and my
what
father's...
What city is she from?
Amsterdam.
Amsterdam, Sin City.
I've never been.
Oh, you should go. I've been many times.
Wow.
Legal prostitution.
Yeah.
And your father? I'm sorry.
Do you know anything about me at all?
It's all right.
They sent me a brief, but...
You didn't read it? I mean, it's fine. You just don't seem to really...
Well, no, I'd rather...
get to know.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I have not seen any of your films.
Oh.
I know you. I guess I know you more by your reputation.
Cynical journalist meets star with fortress-like defenses in sterile setting. That's most celebrity magazine interviews. But this one goes from awkward to incredulous to hostile. She stomps out, so does he. And then, through a series of contrivances, Pierre and Katya end up in her spacious loft, where the cat-and-mouse games really begin. I've seen a lot of two-character psychodramas in the theater and on screen, and even the good ones can be a slog. But Interview, which is co-written and directed by Buscemi, is riveting as drama and cinema. The movie made me remember a playwriting seminar I once took, where we spent weeks breaking down one masterpiece, Ibsen's Rosmersholm, into dramatic beats, small units of dialogue that end in sudden reversals or shifts in focus. The beats are the heartbeats of a scene, and Buscemi understands them organically. He chooses, like Van Gogh, to shoot with three cameras, each coming in close, so that the audience is inside the character's relentless struggle for control of the space, the rhythms, the flow of information, true and false. Because Interview begins with Pierre, because we know he's been through wars and carries shrapnel scars, because we see the overprivileged Katya through his eyes, we're on his side for much of the film. But as he grows more drunk and devious when he peeks at her private emails, our sympathies turn. Maybe Katya isn't so vapid. Maybe her counter-offenses, the way she exploits her beauty and celebrity, are a mark of sanity. It's a little disappointing when Interview comes to a melodramatic head, when there has to be a resolution, a hero and a villain, a winner and a loser. The movie is more tantalizing when it's amorphous, when our sympathies teeter back and forth between these two flawed people. But Buscemi's grip never slackens. As an actor, he evinces a thick-lipped, clammy distaste that's somehow magnetic. He's like a hip ghoul. And as a director, he gives Sienna Miller a dream showcase. I wonder if Miller came up short as Warhol darling Edie Sedgwick in the recent biopic Factory Girl, because no matter how hard she tried and how terrific she was in the big moments, she couldn't be a blank, a non-actress. She's a stupendous actress. Her Katya is lazy but wily, and she's increasingly turned on by the game she keeps insisting she doesn't want to play. Interview is a danse macabre in which she's always on point.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
Thank you.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Rocket Science. It's a new coming-of-age movie about a stuttering teenager who joins the high school debate team. Director Jeffrey Blitz won a Sundance Film Festival Award for the partly autobiographical movie. Blitz also directed the acclaimed documentary Spellbound. Join us for the next Fresh Air.